Against all advice, you used the pillars repeatedly over a very short period. I'm not talking about your coming and going each day. I'm suggesting that once a month you could come to take some scrolls and drop off what you had translated. From what I've read, there were skilled messengers who used the pillars at least that frequently and possibly more often.
No, I put finality in the word. He cocked his head to the other side.
Then why don't you and Molly come live in Buckkeep and bring the baby? Easy enough for us to find a competent manager for Withywoods. And B would have all the advantages that we earlier spoke about. You could help me with the translations and other tasks, get to know young Lant, and I'm sure Molly would enjoy seeing Nettle more frequently and...
No, I said it again firmly. I had no desire to take up the other tasks he might pass back to me, nor for him to see my simple child. I'm happy where I am, Shade. I'm at peace, and I intend to remain so. He sighed noisily.
Very well, then, very well.
He suddenly sounded elderly and petulant. It was unnerving when he added,
I miss you, my boy. There's no one left with whom I can speak as freely as I do with you. I suspect we are a dying breed.
I suspect you are right, I agreed, and did not add that perhaps that was a good thing. Shade and I left our discussion there. I think he finally accepted that I had stepped away from the inner politics of Buckkeep Court. I would come when there was urgent need, but I would never again live in the castle and be a party to his inner councils. Rosemary would have to step up to that role, and behind her must come whatever apprentice they chose. It would not be Fitzvigilant. I wondered if the lad would be disappointed or relieved. In the time that followed, I both dreaded and expected that Shade would try again to draw me back. He did not. Scrolls were delivered for translation, and my work was carried away from me 5 or 6 times a year. Twice his couriers were journeymen, skill students who arrived and departed through the pillars. I refused to allow him to provoke me. The second time it happened, I confirmed with Nettle that she knew of it. She said little, but after that his messengers arrived on horseback. Although Nettle often touched minds with me, and dutiful sometimes, Shade seemed to have decided to set me free. And sometimes, at odd wakeful moments, I wondered if I was disappointed or relieved to be finally clear of the darker side of Farseer politics.
Chapter 9 A Childhood.
It is as I feared for young Lant. He is completely unsuitable for quiet work. When I first told him that I would be ending his apprenticeship and finding him a more suitable post, I was unprepared for how dramatically upset he would be. He begged both Rosemary and me to give him a second chance. Against my own better judgment, I agreed. I must be becoming both softer of heart and feebler of mind, for of course it was not a kindness. We continued to train him in the physical skills and the requisite knowledge. He is very nimble of finger and hand, excellent at sleight, but not as quick to remember the recipes that one must master for use in an instant. Still, I confess I had hope that the lad would follow in my footsteps. Rosemary had less doubt of him and proposed that we give him a challenge. I set him a theft, and he accomplished it. Rosemary proposed a minor poisoning. His target was but a guardsman. We told him the man had taken bribes and was actively spying for a Chalcedian nobleman. Nonetheless, over the course of 3 days and ample opportunities, Lant was unable to achieve his task. He returned to us shamed and despondent. He simply could not bring himself to end a life. I refrained from telling him that the poison was merely a finely ground spice and would have done the man no harm. I am glad we tested him on a subject that was not truly a threat to anyone. The result is that Lant now realizes he is unsuited to this profession. He has, to my surprise, said that he does not mind if he cannot be my apprentice, so long as he does not lose my friendship. And so, to ease his transition, I think I shall keep him here in Buckkeep for a time longer. I will see that he receives sufficient education to be a tutor and weapons training that will fit him as a bodyguard as well. Only to you will I admit that I am sadly disappointed in him. I was so certain I had found a worthy successor. Fortunately, a second candidate has been located and her training begun. She seems to show an aptitude, but then, so did Lant. We shall see. I tell you all this, of course, in the greatest confidence in your discretion. Strange, where once I taught you never to entrust such things to paper, now it is the only way I can be certain that no one else in our coterie shall be privy to my thoughts. How times change.
Unsigned and unaddressed scroll. Oh, the things we discover and the things we learn much too late. Worse are the secrets that are not secrets, the sorrows we live with, but do not admit to one another. B was not the child we had both hoped for. I hid my disappointment from Molly, and I think she did the same for me. The slow months and then the year ticked past, and I saw little change in our daughter's abilities. It aged Molly, taking a toll on both her body and her spirit, as she allowed no one else to care for the child and silently contained her growing sorrow. I wanted to help her, but the child clearly avoided my touch. For a time I sank into a darkness of spirit, losing appetite and the will to do anything. My days always seemed to end with thunderous headaches and a sour belly. I woke at night and could not find sleep again, only anxiety over the child. Our baby remained a baby, small and passive. Shade's eagerness to plan for her education and eventual marriage became a sour-sweet memory. Once, there had been a time when we could hope for such things, but the passing year stole all such dreams from us. I do not recall how old B was the first time Molly broke down and wept in my arms.
"I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry,"
she said, and it took me some time to understand that she blamed herself for our simple child.
"I was too old,"
she told me through her tears.
"And she will never be right. Never, never, never."
"Let's not be hasty," I told her, with a calmness I did not feel. Why had we hidden our fears from each other? Perhaps because sharing them, as we did now, made them more real. I tried to deny them. "She's healthy," I told my Molly as she sobbed in my arms. I bent to whisper the words by her ear. "She eats well. She sleeps. Her skin is smooth. Her eyes are clear. She's small and perhaps slow to do things, but she will grow and..."
"Stop," she begged me in a dull little voice. "Stop, Fitz."
She pulled a little away and looked up at me. Her hair clung to her wet face like a widow's veil. She sniffed once.
"Pretending won't change it. She's simple, and not just simple, but weak in her body. She doesn't roll over or hold her head strongly. She doesn't even try. She just lies in her cradle and stares. She hardly even cries." And what was there for me to say to that? She was a woman who had birthed 7 healthy children. B was the first baby I'd ever experienced. "Is she truly so different from what she should be?" I asked helplessly.
Molly nodded slowly.
And ever will be.
But she's ours, I objected softly. She's our bee. Perhaps she is what she's meant to be. I don't recall how I intended her to hear those words. I knew I did not deserve it when she gave a sudden sob and then hugged me tightly, asking my chest,
Then you are not bitterly disappointed and shamed by her? You can still love her? You still love me?
Of course, I said. Of course and always. And even though I had comforted her by chance rather than by intent, I was glad I had done so. Yet we had opened a door that could not be closed. Once we had admitted that our little girl would likely be always as she was now, we had to talk about it. Yet we did not speak of it before the servants, nor in the light of day, but at night, in our bed, with the child that had so wounded us sleeping nearby in a cradle. For though we could admit it, we could not accept it. Molly faltered her milk and tried to coax the tiny thing to sip cow's milk and then goat's milk with very little success. Our baby's health baffled me. Many a young creature had I tended in my life, and yet I had never known one that ate with an appetite, slept well, appeared full of good health, and yet did not grow. I tried to encourage her to move her limbs, but I quickly learned that she did not seem to want me to handle her at all. Placid and calm when left to herself, she would not meet my gaze when I bent over her crib. If I picked her up, she would lean away from me, and then with her feeble strength try to fling herself from my arms. If I insisted on holding her and flexing her legs and moving her arms, she rapidly went from wails to angry screams. After a time, Molly begged me not to try, for she feared that somehow I was causing her pain. And I gave way to her wishes, though my wit showed me no sense of pain from her, only alarm. Alarm that her father would try to hold her. Is it possible to express how painful that was for me? The servants were at first curious about her, and then pitying. Molly all but hissed at them, and kept all care of the child to herself. To them, she would never admit anything was wrong. But late at night, her worries and fears for her child grew darker.
What will become of her after I am gone?
She asked me one evening. We will make provision for her, I said. Molly shook her head.
People are cruel, she said. Who could we trust that much?
Nettle, I suggested. Molly shook her head again.
Must I sacrifice one daughter's life to be caretaker for the other?
She asked me, and to that I had no answer. When one has been disappointed for so long, hope becomes the enemy. One cannot be dashed to the earth unless one is lifted first, and I learned to avoid hope. When midway through B's second year of life, Molly began to tell me that she was getting stronger and could hold her head more steadily, I nodded and smiled, but did little more than that. But at the end of her second year, she could roll over, and shortly after that, she began to sit without support. She grew, but remained tiny for her age. In her third year, she began to crawl and then to pull herself to a stand. In her fourth year, she toddled about the room, a peculiar sight to see a child so tiny walking. At five, she trotted behind her mother everywhere. She began to have teeth, and she made garbled noises that only Molly could interpret. The oddest things seemed to excite her. The texture of a piece of weaving, or the wind stirring a cobweb, would catch her attention. Then the little thing would shake her hands wildly and gabble out nonsense. Every now and then, a word would burst from her lips, embedded in a stream of burbled sound. It was both maddening and sweet to hear Molly talk to her child, keeping up her half of an imaginary conversation. We kept Bee mostly to ourselves. Her older siblings did not visit as often as they once had, for growing families and the demands of their occupations kept them busy at their homes. They visited when they could, which was not often. They treated Bee kindly, but they realized that pitying her was useless. She would be what she would be. They saw that Molly seemed content with her, and possibly gave no more thought to the child that comforted their mother as she aged. Hap, my fostered son, came and went on his minstrel wanderings. He most often arrived in the coldest months to spend a moon with us. He sang and played pipes, and Bee was the most avid listener that any minstrel could ask for. She would focus her pale blue eyes on him, and her little mouth would hang ajar as she listened. She would not willingly go to bed while Hap was there, unless he followed her to her room and played her a soft, slow tune until she slept. Perhaps that was why he accepted Bee as she was, and when he visited, he always brought her a simple present, such as a string of bright beads or a soft scarf figured with roses. Of all her brothers and sisters, Nettle came most often in those early years. I could tell she longed to hold her sister, but Bee reacted to her touch much as she did to mine, and so Nettle had to be content with being beside her sister, but unable to tend to her needs. Very late one night, as I left my private study, my route took me past the door of Bee's nursery. I saw a light burning through the half-open door and paused, thinking perhaps Bee had taken sick and Molly was sitting up with her. But as I peered in, I saw not Molly, but Nettle, sitting by her sister's bed, looking down at her with a face of tragic wistfulness. She was speaking softly. For years I imagined a sister. Someone to share dreams with, to braid each other's hair and tease about boys, and take long walks with me. I thought I would teach you to dance, and we would have secrets, and cook together late at night when everyone else was asleep. And here you are at last. But we will have none of that, will we? Yet this I will promise you, little Bee. No matter what happens to our parents, I will always care for you. And then my Nettle lowered her face into her hands and wept. I knew then that she mourned for the sister she had imagined, just as I still longed for the perfect little girl I had dreamed we would have. I had no comfort for either of us, and I left that scene silently. Since her birth, Bee had accompanied Molly everywhere, in a sling or riding on Molly's hip, or tottering along behind her. Sometimes I wondered if she feared to leave the child alone. When Molly went about her regular tasks at Withywood's, from supervising the servants to managing her own hives, honey and candle-making, tasks she still seemed to enjoy, Bee was with her, watching and listening. Now that the babe had discovered she could make sounds, Molly redoubled her efforts with her. She did not speak in the babyish sing-song I'd hear the servants use on the rare occasions when they spoke to Bee. Instead, Molly earnestly explained every aspect of her work, as if Bee might one day need to know how to smoke a hive, or strain hot wax for candles, or polish silver, or make a bed. And Bee, in her simple way, mirrored Molly's earnestness, peering at what she was shown and gabbling back at her. My most unnerving experience was when I went to seek Molly one summer day and found her tending her hives. Over our years, I'd become accustomed to Molly's calm acceptance that her bees might blanket her arms in the course of her beekeeping. What I did not expect was to see small Bee standing beside her mother, holding a bucket and cloaked in bees. The child was smiling beatifically, her eyes almost closed. Every now and then she would giggle and give a tiny wiggle as if the fuzzy creatures had tickled her. "Molly," I said in a soft warning voice, for my lady was so intent on her tasks that I was not sure she had seen what was happening to our child. She turned slowly, ever mindful of her buzzing charges. "The baby," I said with quiet urgency. "The bees have her." Molly looked down and behind her. A slow smile appeared on her face. "Bee, are you tending the hives with me?" Our little daughter looked up and babbled something to her. Molly laughed. "She's fine, dear. Not scared at all." But I was. "Bee, come away. Come to Papa," I coaxed her. She turned and looked past me. She never willingly met my eyes. She babbled at her mother again.
She's fine, dear. She says you are worried because you don't know the bees like she and I do. Go on, we'll be along presently.
And so I left them and spent an anxious hour in my study. I wondered if my child was witted, and if it was possible for a witted child to bond to a hive of bees.
Don't be ridiculous, the wolf in me snorted,
and insisted that if it were true, he would have sensed it. I could only hope so. Another year passed, and Bee slowly grew. Our lives changed, for Molly centered her days on our daughter, and I circled the two of them, marveling at what they shared. By the time Bee was 7, she was a genuine help to her mother in her simple way. I could see Molly was slowing and feeling the burden of her years. Bee could pick up what Molly had dropped, could harvest the herbs that Molly pointed out, or bring her items from the lowest shelves in the sewing room. She looked like a little pixie as she followed her mother and assisted in her small ways. Molly had the softest wool, dyed in the brightest colors she could create, as much to make Bee happy as to make her easy to see in the deep grass of the meadows. She was no taller than waist high on Molly when she was 7. Her pale blue eyes and blonde brows lent her a perpetually startled expression, and her wildly curly hair added to it. Her hair flew into stubborn knots at the slightest breeze and grew so slowly that Molly despaired of her ever looking like a girl. Then, when it did reach her shoulders in a wild cloud of ringlets, it was so fine that Molly resorted to wetting it, combing it, and braiding it in a long tail down her back. They came to show me, with my little girl dressed in a simple yellow tunic and green leggings, of the sort that Molly and I had worn as children. I smiled to see her and told Molly, "That's the smallest warrior I've ever seen." For so the soldiers of Buck had always worn their hair tailed back. Bee surprised me by crowing with delight at my comment. And so our days passed, and Molly took great pleasure in our peculiar child, and I took satisfaction in her pleasure. Despite her years, Molly would romp like a child with our bee, seizing her and tossing her high, or chasing her recklessly around and sometimes through the manicured flower and herb beds of Patience's garden. Round and round they would go, until Molly was wheezing and coughing for breath. Bee would halt as soon as Molly did, and go to stand close to her mother and look up at her with fond concern. There were times when I longed to join in, to spring out and pounce on my cub, and roll her on the grass to hear her laugh, but I knew that would not be the response I would get from her. For despite Molly's assurance that our child did not dislike me, Bee remained distant from me. She rarely came closer than arm's length, and if I sat down near her to see her little bit of needlework, she would always hunch her shoulders and turn slightly away from me. She seldom met my eyes. On a few occasions when she fell asleep beside Molly in her chair, I would pick her up and try to carry her off to her bed. But at my touch, awake or asleep, she would stiffen and then arch like a fighting fish, flinging herself away from me. It would be a struggle for me to set her safely down, and after a number of efforts, I gave up trying to touch her. I think Molly was relieved when I surrendered to Bee's will in this. So Molly tended to all Bee's personal needs. She taught our child to keep herself clean and to tidy her room as much as a small person was able. Molly had a little bed built for her and bedding of a matching size. She was required to keep her playthings in order and to do all things for herself as if she were a peasant child. Of this, I approved. Molly taught her to gather from the woods mushrooms, berries, and herbs that we could not easily grow in our gardens. In the gardens and hothouses, I would find them together, picking caterpillars from leaves or gathering herbs to dry. I would pass Molly's wax room and see small Bee standing on the table, holding a wick straight as Molly carefully poured hot wax. There they strained the golden honey from the combs and packed it into fat little pots for our winter sweetness. They made a perfect unit, Molly and Bee. It came to me that though Bee was not the child I had dreamed we would have, she was perfect for Molly. She was utterly devoted to her mother, intent on every shift of the expression on her face. If, in their closeness, they closed me out, I tried not to resent it. Molly deserved the joy she took in this child. So I was content to hover at the edges of their world, a moth at a window, looking in at warmth and light. Slowly, I began to forsake my private study, and instead to take my translation work to the room where Bee had been born. By the time Bee was 7, I spent almost every evening in that warmly lit room. Molly's softly flickering candles scented it with heather and lavender, or sage or rose, depending on her mood. She and Bee would do simple stitching together, while Molly softly sang the old learning songs about herbs and bees and mushrooms and flowers. I was at my work one evening, the fire crackling softly, and Molly humming over some embroidery she was working onto the neck of a little red nightgown for Bee, when I became aware that my daughter had left off sorting skeins of thread for her mother and had approached my table. I was careful not to look at her. It was as if a hummingbird hovered near me. I could not recall that she had ever voluntarily come so close to me. I feared that if I turned, she would flee. And so I painstakingly continued to copy the old illustration on a scroll about the properties of nightshade and its relatives. It asserted that one branch of the family that grew in desert regions bore red fruit that could be eaten. I was skeptical of such a claim for a toxic plant, but nonetheless I copied the text and did my best to reproduce the illustrations of leaves, starry flowers, and hanging fruit. I had begun to ink the flowers in with yellow. This, I surmised, was what had brought Bee to my shoulder. I listened to her open-mouthed breathing and became aware that Molly was no longer humming. I did not need to turn my head to know she was watching our child with as much curiosity as I felt. A small hand touched the edge of my table and spidered slowly to the edge of the page I was working on. I pretended not to notice. I dipped my brush again and added another yellow petal. As softly as a pot bubbling on the hearth, Bee murmured something. "Yellow," I said, as if I were Molly pretending to know her thoughts. "I'm painting the little flower yellow." Again the bubbling mutter, this time a bit louder with more of a plea in it. "Green," I told her. I lifted the vial of ink and showed it to her. "The leaves will be this green at the edges, and I will mix green and yellow for the center, and green and black for the veins of the leaves." The little hand fumbled at the corner of my page. Her fingers lifted it and tugged. "Careful," I cautioned her, and received a cascade of bubbling muttering in a pleading tone. "Fits," Molly gently rebuked me. "She's asking you for paper, and a quill and ink." I transferred my gaze to Molly. She met my eyes steadily, her brows raised, that I could be either so stupid or so unreasonable. The happily affirmative note in Bee's babbling seemed to confirm that she was right. I looked down at Bee. She lifted her face and looked past me, but did not retreat. "Paper," I said, and did not hesitate as I took a sheet of the best quality paper that Shade had sent to me. "A quill." It was one I had just cut. "And ink." I slid a small well of black ink across the table. I set the paper and the quill on the edge of my desk. Bee stood silent for a moment. Her mouth worked, and then she pointed a small finger and trilled at me. "Colored ink," Molly specified, and Bee gave a wriggle of delight. I surrendered. "We'll have to share then," I told her. I moved a chair to the other side of my table, set a cushion on it, and then arranged Bee's supplies where she could reach them. She surprised me with the alacrity with which she mounted to this throne. "You dip just the pointed end of the quill into the ink pot," I began. I stopped. I had ceased to exist in Bee's world. Her entire focus was on the pen that she carefully inked and then set to her page. I froze and watched the child. Obviously, she had been observing me for some time. I had expected her to dunk the quill and smear ink across the page. Instead, her little hand moved with precision. Her effort was not without blotches and drips. No one uses a pen correctly the very first time, but the image that emerged onto the page was intricately and intimately drawn. In silence, she filched my pen wipe, cleaned the quill. She blew on the black ink to dry it, and claimed the yellow and then the orange ink. I watched in rapt silence, scarce aware when Molly drew near. A bee, exactly the scale of a live one, emerged from the pen onto the paper. There came a moment when our bee heaved a huge sigh of satisfaction, as if she had consumed the perfect meal and stood back from her work. I examined it without moving closer to her. The delicate antennae, the panes of the wings, and the bright bands of yellow shaded to orange. "It's her name, isn't it?" I said quietly to Molly. Bee shot me a rare look that met my eyes and then skated away. Her annoyance with me was plain. She drew the paper closer as if to protect it from me and hunched over it. The pen once more visited the black well and then scratched carefully over the paper. I glanced at Molly, who wore a proud and secretive smile. I watched in growing suspense until Bee leaned back from the page. There, in careful characters that mirrored Molly's hand, was lettered, "Bee." I was not aware my mouth was hanging open until Molly put her fingers under my chin and pushed it shut. Tears welled in my eyes. "She can write."
"Yes."
I took a breath and carefully capped my excitement. "But only her name. Does she understand they are letters, that they mean something?" Molly made a small sound of exasperation.
"Of course she does. Fitz, did you think I would neglect her education as mine was? She reads along with me, so she recognizes the letters. But this is the first time she has taken pen in hand and written."
Her smile trembled a little.
"In truth, I'm almost as surprised as you to see her do so. To know the shape of a letter on the page is so different from reproducing it on paper. Truly, I did not do as well as she has the first time I tried to write."
Bee was now ignoring both of us as a twining vine of honeysuckle began to emerge from her pen. I wrote no more that night. I ceded all my inks and my best quills to my little daughter and allowed her to fill page after page of my best paper with illustrations of flowers, herbs, butterflies, and insects. I would have needed to study the live plant to capture it well. She drew it forth from her memory and captured it on the page. I went to bed that night a grateful man. I was not at all convinced that Bee understood the concepts of letters, or writing, or reading. What I had seen was someone who could duplicate on paper what she had seen, even if she did not have the model before her. It was a rare enough talent that it gave me hope for her. It put me in mind of Thick, a man prodigiously strong in the skill, even if he could not fully grasp the concept of what he was doing when he used it. That night, in bed with Molly warm beside me, I had the rare pleasure of reaching out with the skill and rousing Shade from a sound sleep.
"What?"
he demanded of me in a tone of reproach.
"Do you remember the herbal scrolls from that Spice Island trader that we set aside as beyond my skill to copy? The tattered ones that might be of elderling origin?"
"Of course. What of them?"
"Send them to me, with a good supply of paper. Oh, and a set of rabbit hair brushes. And have you any of that purple ink from the Spice Islands?"
"Do you know how much that costs, boy?"
"Yes, and I know that you can afford it if it's used well. Send me 2 bottles of that as well."
I smiled as I closed my mind to his hailstorm of questions. They were still rattling against my walls as I sank into sleep. Chapter 10. My Own Voice.
This is the dream I love the best. I had it once. I've tried to make it come back, but it does not. 2 wolves are running. That is all. They run by moonlight across an open hillside and then into an oak forest. There is little underbrush, and they do not slow. They are not even hunting. They are just running, taking joy in the stretch of their muscles and the cool air flowing into their open jaws. They owe nothing to no one. They have no decisions, no duties, and no king. They have the night and the running, and it is enough for them. I long to be that complete.
Dream Journal of B. Farseer.
I freed my tongue when I was 8 years old. I remember the day very clearly. My fostered brother, Hap, more like an uncle to me, had paid us a brief visit the day before. His gift to me was not a little pipe, or a string of beads, or such simple things as he had brought me on previous visits. This time, he had a soft packet wrapped in a rough brown fabric. He put it on my lap, and when I sat looking at it, unsure of what to do next, my mother took out her small belt knife, cut the string that bound it, and unfolded the wrappings. Within were a pink blouse, a vest of lace, and a set of layered pink skirts. I had never seen such garments. They were from Bington, he told my mother, as she gently touched the intricate lace. The sleeves were long and full, and the skirts rested on a pillow of petticoats and were overlaid with pink lace. My mother held them up to me, and for a wonder, they seemed to be the right size. The next morning, she helped me put them on and caught her breath to see me when the final sash was tied. Then she made me stand still for a weary time while she worried my hair into reluctant order. When we went down to breakfast, she opened the door and ushered me in as if I were the queen. My father lifted his brows in astonishment, and Hap gave a whoop of pleasure to see me. I ate breakfast so carefully, enduring the chafing of the lace and keeping the sleeves from dragging through my plate. I bore the weight of the garments bravely as we stood in front of the manor and wished Hap a pleasant journey. And mindful of my glory, I walked carefully through the kitchen gardens and seated myself on a bench there. I felt very grand. I arranged my pink skirts and tried to smooth my hair, and when Elm and Leah came out of the kitchens with buckets of vegetable parings to take down to the chicken house, I smiled at them both. Leah looked away uneasily, and Elm stuck her tongue out. My heart sank. I had supposed, foolishly, that such extravagant garments might win me their regard. Several times I had heard, as Elm intended I should, that I was
dressed like a butcher's boy,
when I wore my usual tunic and leggings. After they had passed me by, I sat a time longer, trying to think it through. Then the sun went behind a bank of low clouds, and I suddenly could not stand any more chafing from the high lace collar. I sought out my mother and found her straining wax. I stood before her, lifting my pink skirts and petticoats.
Too heavy.
She understood my garbled words as she always did. She took me to my room and helped me change into leggings of dark green, a tunic of lighter green, and my soft boots. I had reached a decision. I had come to understand what I must do. I had always been aware there were other children at Withy Woods. For the first 5 years of my life, I was so bonded to my mother and so small that I had very little to do with them. I saw them, in passing, as my mother carried me through the kitchens, or as I trotted at her heels through the corridors. They were the sons and daughters of the servants, born to be part of Withy Woods, and growing up alongside me, even if they sprouted up taller, much more swiftly than I did. Some were old enough to have tasks of their own, such as the scullery girls Elm and Leah, and the kitchen lad Taffy. I knew there were children who helped with the poultry and sheep in the stables, but those I seldom saw. There were also little ones, infants and small children who were both too small to be given work and too young to be separated from their mothers. Some of them were of a size with me, but far too babyish to hold my interest. Elm was a year older than I was, and Leah a year younger, but both of them were taller than I was by a head. Both had grown up in the pantries and kitchens of Withy Woods and shared their mother's opinions of me. When I was 5, they had shown a pitying tolerance for me. But both pity and tolerance were gone by the time I was 7. Smaller in stature than they were, I was still more competent at the tasks my mother entrusted to me. Yet because I did not speak, They considered me stupid. I had learned to keep my silence with everyone except my mother. Not only the children, but even the grown servants would mock my gabbling and pointing when they thought I was not near. I was certain it was from their parents that the children learned their dislike of me. As young as I was then, I still understood instinctively that they feared if their children were near me, somehow they would become tainted with my oddness. Unlike their elders, the children avoided me without bothering to pretend it was anything but dislike for me. I would watch their play from a distance, longing to join in. But the moment I approached, they would gather their simple dolls, scatter the acorn and flower picnic they'd been sharing, and race off. Even if I gave chase, they easily outran me. They could climb trees whose lower branches I could not reach. If I dogged their steps too much, they simply retreated to the kitchen. I was often shooed out of that room with a kindly voiced, "Now, Mistress B, run along and play where it's safe. Here you'll be trodden upon, or scolded. Off you go." And all the while, Elm and Leah would make simpering faces and shooing motions from behind their mother's skirts. Taffy, I feared. He was 9, bigger and heavier than Elm and Leah. He was the meat boy for the kitchen, bringing a freshly slaughtered chicken or lugging a butchered and skinned lamb. To me, he seemed massive. He was boyishly blunt and direct in his dislike of me. Once, when I followed the kitchen children down to the creek where they intended to sail some walnut shell boats, Taffy turned on me and pelted me with pebbles until I fled. He had a way of saying, "Bee," that made my name an insult and a synonym for stupid. The two girls did not dare join in his mockery of me, but oh, how they enjoyed it. If I had told my mother, she would have told my father, and I am certain that all the children would have been banned from Withy Woods. So I did not. As much as they disliked and scorned me, all the more I longed for their company. It was true I could not play with them, but I could watch them and learn how to play. Climbing trees, setting walnut boats with leaf sails afloat, contests of jumping and skipping and tumbling, little mocking songs, how to catch a frog. All of these things children learn from other children. I watched Taffy walk on his hands, and in the privacy of my bedroom bruised myself in 100 places until I could cross the room without falling. I did not know to beg for a spinning top from the market until I had spied Taffy's red one. From a distance, I learned to whistle with my lips or with a blade of grass between my thumbs. I hid and waited until they had departed before I tried to swing on a rope tied to a tree branch or venture into a secret bower built from fallen branches. I think my father suspected how I spent my time. When my mother told him of my desire, he bought me not just a spinning top, but a jumping jack, a little tumbler fastened to 2 sticks with a twist of string suspending him. Of an evening, when I would sit by the hearth and play with those simple toys, he would watch me from lowered eyes. I felt in his gaze the same hunger I felt when I watched the other children play. I felt I stole from them when I spied on them. And they felt the same, for whenever they discovered me watching them, they would drive me away with their shouts and name-calling. Taffy was the only one who dared pelt me with pine cones and acorns, but the others shouted and cheered when he hit me. My silence and timidity made them bold in their attacks. Such a mistake. Or not. When I could not join them, I followed and played where they had played after they had left. There was a place by a creek where slender willows grew thick. In early spring, they wove the little trees together, and by summer, the trees had grown into a shady arch of leafy branches. It became their playhouse, where they brought bread and butter from the kitchen and ate it on plates of big leaves. Their cups were leaves too, spindled to hold a bit of water from the stream. And Taffy was Lord Taffy there, and the girls were ladies with necklaces of golden dandelions and white daisies. How I longed to join them at that game! I had thought that a lacy pink dress might win me admittance to their circle. It had not. So that day I followed them stealthily, and I waited until they were called away to their chores before I ventured in. I sat on their mounded moss chairs. I fanned myself with a fan of fern fronds that Elm had made and left there. They had built a little bed of pine boughs in the corner, and on a warm and sunny day, I lay upon it. The sun beat down, but the bent branches of the shelter let in only a dappling of it. I closed my eyes and watched the light on my eyelids and smelled the fragrance of the broken boughs and sweet smell of the earth itself. I must have dozed. When I opened my eyes, it was too late. All three of them stood in the entrance, looking down at me. I sat up slowly. Against the sunshine outside, there were silhouettes. I tried to find a smile and could not. I sat very still, looking up at them. Then, as if the sun had come out from behind clouds, I remembered this day. I had dreamed it and all of the many paths that could diverge from it. I could not remember when I had dreamed it, and then it seemed that perhaps it was a dream I was going to have, or a dream of something. A dream of a crossroads, a place not of two roads intersecting, but of thousands. I folded my legs under me and stood up slowly. I could not see the children for the overlay of dreams and shadows around them. I tried to study the myriad paths. One, I felt, led to something I desperately wanted. But which one? What must I do to put my feet on that path? If I went along another path, I died. There, they mocked me. There, my mother came running when I screamed, and there... I could not make it happen. I had to allow it. I had to let the path form around me from the words I tried to say, and the taunts they flung at me. The moment came when I could have fled, but I was both too afraid to move and aware that only this path led to where I longed to go. The girls held me, their fingers biting into my thin wrists until the flesh stood up in ridges that were red, and then white. They shook me, and my head snapped back and forth on my neck, so hard that I saw flashes of light behind my eyes. I tried to speak, and it came out as gobbling. They shrieked with laughter and gobbled back at me. Tears sprang into my eyes. "Do it again, Bee! Make the turkey noise!" Taffy stood over me, so tall he had to crouch inside the bower. I looked up at him and shook my head. Then Taffy slapped me, hard. Once, and it rocked my head one direction, and then again almost instantly from the other side, and I knew this was how his mother slapped him sometimes, rocking his head back and forth so that his ears rang. When the blood flooded salt into my mouth, I knew it was done. I was on the path. And now it was time to twist free of them and run, 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 because from that point there were so many paths that led to my lying on the earth, broken in ways that could never be mended. And so I snapped my wrists from their grips and pushed through the willow trunks and out through a gap none of them could negotiate. I fled, not toward the manor, but into the wild part of the woods. In a moment, they were after me. They chased me, but a small person can run doubled over and use the trails made by rabbits and foxes. And when the trail led into a thick and prickly bramble, I went where they were far too large to follow me, without tearing their clothes and skin. In the middle of a briar patch, I found a hollow, a place where soft grass grew, and the bramble shielded me all around. I hunkered down in it and froze there, shaking with fright and pain. I'd done it, but oh, the cost! I heard them shouting and beating the edges of the bramble with branches, as if I would be foolish enough to leave its shelter. They called me vile names, but could not see me, nor tell for certain that I still hid there. I made no sound as I opened my mouth and tipped my face down to let the blood run out. Something in my mouth had torn, a piece that went from the underside of my tongue to the bottom of my mouth. It hurt. It bled a lot. Later, when they were gone, and I tried to spit out the blood, it hurt even more. My tongue moved in my mouth now, flapping like a piece of leather on an old shoe. When the afternoon was ending and the shadows deepening, I crawled out of my briar bower. I went back to the manor by a long and winding way. I stopped at the creek and washed the blood from my mouth. When I went in to the evening meal, both my parents were horrified at the spreading blue bruises on my cheeks and my blackened left eye. My mother asked me how it had happened, but I only shook my head and did not even try to speak. I ate little. My free-flopping tongue got in the way. Twice I bit myself before I gave up and sat staring at the food I longed for. For the next 5 days it was hard to eat, and my tongue felt like a strange object that flapped in my mouth. And yet, it was the path I had chosen. And when the pain lessened, I was shocked at how freely I could move my tongue. Alone in my room, after my mother thought me asleep, I practiced my words aloud. The sounds that had eluded me before, the sudden starts and sharp endings of words, I now could make. I still did not converse, but now it was because I chose not to, not because I could not. To my mother, I began to speak more clearly, but only in a very soft voice. Why? Because I feared the change I had wrought in myself. Already my father looked at me differently since he had seen I could hold a pen. And dimly, I knew that the girls had dared to attack me because I had worn the pink dress that declared a status higher than theirs, one they felt I did not deserve. If I began to speak, would all the servants retreat from me, kindly cook Nutmeg and our grave steward? I feared that speech would only make me more of a pariah than I already was. I longed so for companionship of some kind. It was to be my downfall. I should have learned my lesson from what had befallen me. I did not. I was lonely, and the lonely heart has hungers that can overpower both common sense and dignity. Summer advanced, my mouth healed, and I began again to spy on the other children. At first, I kept my distance, but it was too frustrating to view them from afar, where I could not hear what they said or see what they did. So I learned to go ahead of them and shinny up a tree to look down on their games. I thought myself very clever. It had to end badly, and it did. That day is as vivid as a dream to me still. They had caught me watching them when I sneezed. For a time they had me treed, and I was fortunate that acorns and pine cones were the best ammunition that Taffy could find. At last I thought of climbing higher up the tree, out of his range. But a tree slender enough for a small child to shinny up is thin enough for 3 hearty children to shake. For a time I rode the whipping top, and then I fell, flung in a wide arc to land flat on my back. Airless and stunned, I lay helpless. They were silenced and awestruck as they crept up on me. "Did we kill her?" Elm asked. I heard Leah suck in a terrified breath, and then Taffy shouted boldly,
"Let's be sure of it, then."
That brought me out of my daze. I staggered to my feet and ran. They stared after me, and I thought they would let me go. Then with a roar from Taffy of,
"Get her!"
They came after me, as eager as rabbit hounds on a trail. My legs were short, my fall had dazed me, and they came close behind me, yammering and shrieking. I ran blindly, my head down, my hands clasped over it to shield myself from the rocks that Taffy scooped up and flung with ever-increasing accuracy. I did not plan to flee toward the lambing shelter. I ran silent as a hare, but when a large body suddenly stepped in front of me and snatched me up high, I shrieked as if I were being killed.
"Quiet, girl!"
Lynn the shepherd barked at me. As quickly as he'd picked me up, he dropped me, and his dog came up to block my pursuers as Lynn turned on them. They had been close on my heels. If he had not been there, they would have caught me that day, and I still wonder if they would have left me alive. Lynn seized Taffy by the back of his collar and swung him up one-handed, while delivering such a powerful smack to his bottom with his free hand that Taffy's whole body arched to the blow. Lynn dropped him and spun on the little girls. They had not been as close, and they nearly managed to get away, but Lynn caught one by the pigtail and the other by the edge of her skirts. Both crumpled before his wrath as he demanded of them,
"What you be doing chasing a tiny child, you great bullies? Shall I teach you what it is to have someone larger than you give you a thrashin'?"
Both girls began to wail. Taffy's chin quivered, but he stood up and clenched his fists at his side. I sat flat where Lynn had dropped me. It was only when he stooped to help me to my feet that he exclaimed,
"Oh, by Edranel, it's worse than fools you are. This is the little mistress sister to Lady Nettle herself. Do you think she'll forget what you've done to her this day? Do you imagine that when you are men and women grown, you'll work in the kitchens or fields as your parents have done for generations before you? Or your children after you? If Holder Badgerlock or Lady Molly does not send your parents and you packing from their lands this very day, I'll be shocked."
"She spied on us,"
wailed Leah.
"She follows us about," Elm accused me. "She's witless, a moron, and she stares at us with ghost eyes."
This last from Taffy. It was the first time I knew that he feared me. Lynn only shook his head.
"She is the daughter of the house, you ninnies. She can go where she will and do as she wishes, poor little mite. What else is she to do? She only wants to play."
"She can't talk," Elm objected, and Taffy added, "She's dumb as a post and simple as a stone. Who can play with an idiot? They should have her tethered inside, they should, and out from underfoot."
I knew he repeated something overheard from adults. Lynn looked from them to me. After my first shriek, I hadn't made a sound. His dog came back to me, and I put an arm across her shaggy back. My fingers sank deep into her silky coat, and I felt her comfort flow up into me. She sat down beside me, and our heads were on a level. The shepherd looked from his dog back to the children.
"Well, whatever she be, it costs you nothing to be kind to her. Now you've put me in a bind here. I should tell the holder that I should, but I've no desire to see your folks turned out of the places they've held for years. I will speak to your parents. You've all three of you too much time on your hands if this is what you get up to. Now, little mistress, let's look at you. Have they hurt you?"
"We didn't touch her," they shouted. "Don't tell the holder. I swear we'll never chase her again,"
Taffy bargained. Lynn had gone down on one knee. He picked up a dried leaf and a burr from my tunic and dared to smooth back my tangle of curls.
"Well, she's not weeping. Maybe not much hurt then. Maybe. Not hurt, little one?"
I drew myself up straight and met his eyes. I put my hands behind me and tightened them into fists, my nails biting hard into my palms to give me courage. I found my voice. With my newly loosened tongue, I formed each word as if it was a gift. "Thank you kindly, Shepherd Lynn. I am not injured." His eyes grew round. Then I shifted my stare to the gaping children. I fought to keep my new voice steady, speaking each word precisely. "I will not tell my father or my mother, nor do you need to do so, I think. These children have realized their error." They stared. I focused my gaze on Taffy and tried to burn holes in him with my eyes. He glared back at me sullenly. Slowly, very slowly, I cocked my head at him. Hatred met hatred in our gazes, but his was greater than mine. What would he fear if not my hate? I knew. I had to remember each muscle in my face, but slowly I constructed, and then let blossom, a fawning smile upon my face. I spoke in a gentle whisper, "Dear Taffy." His eyes bulged at my fond gaze. Then Taffy screamed, more shrilly than I had, and turned and fled. The little girls ran after him. I glanced up at Lynn. His eyes were measuring me, but I did not see disapproval. He turned to watch the fleeing children. I think he was speaking more to the dog than to me as he said,
"They'll beat you and mistreat you if they think you're a dumb brute. Doesn't matter if you're a mule or a dog or a child. And when they find out there's a mind behind the flesh they've been battering, they fear you and leave you alone. Sometimes."
He took a deeper breath and turned an appraising eye on me.
You'll need to watch your back now, mistress. Time you had a dog, is what I'm thinking. You speak to your da about that. Daisy and I, we could find a good pup for you. A smart pup.
I shook my head, and he shrugged in response. I stood, staring after the wailing children until they rounded the corner of the herb garden wall. As soon as they were out of sight, I turned to the dog and buried my face in her coat. I did not cry, but I shook and held tight to her. She stood steady under my grip and turned her head to whine and then nuzzle my ear.
You take care of her, Daisy.
Lynn's voice was deep, and perhaps something more passed between him and the dog than what I heard. I only knew that she was warm and unthreatening and seemed to have no desire to move away from my desperate hug. When finally I lifted my face from her coat, Lynn was gone. I will never know what he made of that encounter. I gave Daisy a final hug and she licked my hand. Then, seeing that I no longer needed her, she trotted off to find her owner. And I made my way back to the house and up to my chamber. I thought of what I had done. None of the children would dare speak of it to their parents. They would have to explain why I said what I said. Shepherd Lynn would, I decided, keep it to himself. How did I know? He had told me to watch my own back and advised me to get a dog. He expected me to handle this myself, and I would. I considered his advice about the dog. No. My father would want to know why I wanted one. I could not tell him, not even through my mother. After my encounter with the children, I took Lynn's advice. I stopped following them and avoided them when I could. Instead, I began to shadow my father to see what he did all day while my mother was about her familiar routine. I flattered myself that he did not notice his small shadow, but later I would discover he had been aware of me. His long hikes about the estate to check on things were taxing for my small legs. If he took a horse, I gave up at once. I feared horses with their long, knobby legs and sudden snorting breaths. Years ago, when I was 5, he had put me on one to teach me to ride. In my terror and distress at his invasive touch and at the height of the animal's back, I had snapped myself out of his grip and vaulted over the animal and onto the hard-packed earth. My father had been terrified he had injured me and had never attempted the experiment again. In my garbled way, I had made excuse to my mother that it had felt rude to sit on someone and expect her to carry me about. And when my mother gave my father that explanation, he had become even more pensive and reluctant to expose me to horses. As I followed him now, I began to regret that. While I dreaded my father's touch and the overwhelming surge of his thoughts into my mind, I still wished to know more of him. If I had been able to ride a horse, I could have followed him, but letting him know that presented difficulties. Since discovering I could draw, he had begun to spend more time with me. Of an evening, he would bring his work to my mother's sitting room. I had my own little table there, with my own inks and pens and paper now. Several times he had shown me mouldering old scrolls with faded illustrations of plants and flowers, and letters I did not recognize. He had conveyed to me that I should try to copy what I saw, but this was something I had no desire to do. There was so much already stored in my mind, flowers and mushrooms and plants I had seen that I wished to capture on the paper. I did not share his obsession for writing again what had already been written. I knew that disappointed him, and yet it was so. My father had never understood my mumbling tongue, and even now I did not speak to him much. I hesitated to draw his attention to me. Even to be in the room with him challenged me. When he looked at me or focused his attention on me, the sheer power of his drenching thoughts terrified me. I dared not let him touch me, and even to meet his eyes was to feel the pull of that whirlpool. And so I avoided him as much as I was able, even though I know it hurt him and grieved my mother. Despite that, he began to try to play with me. He came one night to the fireside with no scrolls to copy. He sat down on the floor near my little table and patted the hearth next to him.
"Come see what I have," he invited me.
Curiosity overcame my dread, and I left my inks and ventured to stand near him.
"Here's a game,"
he told me, and lifted a kerchief that covered a tray. On it were a flower, a white pebble, and a strawberry. I looked at it, mystified. Abruptly, he covered it.
"Tell me what you saw,"
he challenged me. I looked at my mother for explanation. She was in her chair on the other side of the hearth, her hands busy with some needlework. She raised her brows in puzzlement, but prompted me.
"What was on the tray, Bee?"
I stared at her. She lifted a rebuking finger and raised her brows at me. I spoke softly without looking at him. "Flower."
"What else, Bee?"
"Rock." My mother cleared her throat, bidding me try harder. "Berry," I added softly.
"What color flower?"
My father prompted me patiently. "Pink."
"What color rock?"
"White."
"What kind of berry?"
"Strawberry."
"Strawberry,"
my mother corrected me softly. I looked at her. Did she know I could say it correctly? I was not sure if I wanted to speak that clearly for my father. Not yet. My father smiled at me.
"Good. Good, Bee. You got them all. Shall we play again?"
I scooted closer to my mother's feet. I looked up at her, pleading with her to rescue me. "It's an odd game," she ventured, sensing my unease. My father made an amused sound.
"I suppose it is. I used to play it with Shade. He'd add more and more things to the tray, or he'd add something and take something away, and I had to say what was missing. He was training my eyes."
He gave a small sigh. Elbow on knee, he cupped his jaw in his hand.
"I don't know any real games. I didn't have much chance to play with other children."
He looked at me and lifted a helpless hand.
"I just wanted to..."
He sighed away the rest of his words.
"It's a good game,"
my mother said decisively. She stood and then surprised me by sitting down on the floor next to him. She drew me close to her side and put her arm around me.
"Let's play again,"
she said, and I knew she sat by me to give me courage, because she wanted me to play with my father. And so I did. We took turns, my mother and I, as my father added more and more items from a leather bag behind him. At 9 items, my mother threw up her hands. I played on, forgetting to fear him, my focus only on the tray. There came a moment when my father said, not to me but my mother,
"That's all I have."
I lifted my eyes and looked around. My parents seemed hazy, as if I saw them through a fog or at a great distance.
"How many was that?"
my mother asked.
27,
my father said quietly.
"How many could you do as a child?"
my mother asked softly. There was trepidation in her voice. My father took a breath.
"Not 27,
he admitted.
"Not on my first try."
They looked at each other. Then they returned their focus to me. I blinked and felt myself sway slightly.
"I think we are past our time to bed,"
my mother announced in an odd voice. My father nodded mutely. Slowly he began to return his items to his bag. With a groan for her aching joints, my mother clambered to her feet. She led me away to my bed, and that night she sat beside me until I fell asleep. On a day of wide blue skies, studded with fat white clouds, with a soft wind blowing the scents of lavender and heather, my mother and I puttered in her garden together. The sun was past noon, the flowers breathing gentle fragrance all around us. We were both on our hands and knees. I was working with my little wooden trowel, carved by my father to fit my hand, loosening the earth around the oldest beds of lavender. My mother had her shears and was pruning the runaway sprawl of lavender plants. She would stop now and then to catch her breath and rub her shoulder and the side of her neck.
"Oh, I'm so tired of getting old,"
she said once. But then she smiled at me and said, "Look at the fat bee on this blossom. I've cut the stem and he still won't get off. Well, he can just ride along for a while." She had a large basket to save the trimmings in, and this we dragged behind us as we crawled through the lavender bed. It was pleasant, sweet-smelling work, and I was happy. So was she. I know that. She spoke of the odd bits of ribbon she had in her sewing basket and told me that she was going to show me how to make lavender bottles that would hold the fragrance and could be stored in my clothing chest and hers. We need to cut the stems long, because we'll fold the stems over the blossoms, and then we'll lace the ribbons through the stems to hold it all together. They'll be pretty, fragrant, and useful. Just like you. I laughed, and she did too. Then she halted in her work and took a deeper breath. She rocked back on her heels and smiled at me, even as she complained, "I've such a stitch in my side," rubbing her ribs and then moving her hand up to her shoulder. "And my left arm aches so. You would think it would be my right, for that's the hand that's doing all the work." She took hold of the edge of the basket and pushed on it, intending to stand. But the basket overturned and she lost her balance and sprawled into the lavender, crushing the bushes under her. A sweet fragrance rose around her. She rolled herself over on her back and frowned, small lines crinkling her brow. She reached with her right hand and lifted her left and looked at it in wonder. When she let go of it, it fell back to her side. "Well, this is so silly." Her voice was mumbly and soft. She paused and took a deeper breath. With her right hand, she patted my leg. "I'm just going to catch my breath for a moment," she murmured to me, the edges of her words gone rounded. She took a ragged breath and closed her eyes. Then she died. I crawled into the heather alongside her and touched her face. I leaned down and put my head on her chest. I heard the last beat of her heart. Then her breath sighed out, and all went still inside her. Around us, the wind blew softly, and her bees busied themselves in the blossoms. Her body was still warm, and she still smelled like my mother. I put my arms around her and closed my eyes. I rested my head on her breast and wondered what would become of me now that the woman who had loved me so was gone. The day was just cooling when my father came looking for us. He had been to the sheep fields, I knew, for he carried on his arm a big bouquet of the little white roses that grew along the path. He came to the wooden gate in the low stone wall that surrounded the garden, looked in at us, and knew. He knew she was dead before he opened the gate. Still, he ran to us, as if he could run back to a time when it wasn't already too late. He dropped to his knees by her body and set his hands to her. He breathed hard and flung his heart into her, searching her flesh for some sign of life. He dragged me with him, and I knew what he knew. She was irrevocably gone. He gathered us both up to him, threw back his head, and howled. His jaws stretched wide, his face turned up to the sky, and the ridges of muscle in his neck stood out. He made no sound, yet the grief that poured through him and up to the sky soaked me and choked me. I drowned in his sorrow. I put my hands against his chest and tried to lever away from him, but could not. From impossibly far away, I felt my sister. She battered at him, demanding to know what was wrong. There were others, ones I had never met, shouting into his mind, offering to send soldiers, to lend strength, to do anything for him that could possibly be done. But he could not even verbalize his pain. "It's my mother," my sister suddenly gasped. And, "Leave him alone. Leave us alone." She commanded them all, and they receded like a tide. But still his grief roared on. A storm that battered me with tempest winds that I could not escape. I squirmed wildly, knowing that I was fighting for my sanity and possibly my life. I do not think he even knew he held me trapped between his thundering heart and my mother's cooling body. I wriggled out from under his arm and fell back to the earth and lay there, gasping like a fish out of water. The slight distance I had gained from him was not enough.